We're going to be examining this concept called abolitionist teaching as we try to get our guest here on the phone. But first of all, the 91st Academy Awards. We're going to take a look at them, and the ceremony is happening this Sunday, which got Dean Robbins thinking about moving this about movies set in and around Wisconsin. It's always a thrill to see Wisconsin's capital as a backdrop for a major motion picture. Let's listen.
The 91st Academy Awards ceremony is happening this Sunday, which got Dean Robbins thinking about movies set in and around Madison. It's always a thrill to see Wisconsin's capital city as a backdrop for a major motion picture. Or is that really Madison we're seeing?
I guess I should be glad that Hollywood is interested in Madison. For a mid-sized city tucked away in the heartland, my hometown is figured in a surprising number of major movies. But most of them utterly fail to capture Madison on screen. One of the worst insults to civic pride is setting a movie in Madison but filming the scenes elsewhere. In Away We Go, John Krasinski and Maya Rudolph consider settling here to raise a family. In The Prince and Me, Julia Stiles attends the University of Wisconsin-Madison and falls in love with a Danish prince.
What the hell was that? Why were they calling you Prince Edward?
That's my name.
What? That's crazy. You're a prince and that's why they were taking photos of us?
Yes.
Are there a lot of princes where you're from, or are you kind of it?
In each case, the locations look nothing like the real Madison, which couldn't feel weirder to a local viewer. Where'd my city go? Just as bad are movies filmed in Madison that claim to be happening somewhere else. For example, the period gangster film Public Enemies features the Wisconsin State Capitol, but only as a stand-in for the U.S. Capitol and FBI headquarters. The timeless marble interior almost convinces you you're in Washington, D.C. in the 1930s. That is, until FBI agent Christian Bale faces reporters outside the building. In the background are modern-day Madison storefronts. Oops.
Well, nevertheless, we will get it.
What makes you so sure?
We have two things Dillinger does not.
What are they?
The Bureau's modern techniques of fighting crime scientifically, and the visionary leadership of our director, J. Edgar Hoover.
Ironically, Hollywood movies both shot and set in Madison are the worst of the bunch. In theory, locals would enjoy seeing Bascom Hill as itself in Four Keeps, starring Molly Ringwald as a pregnant UW-Madison student. The same goes for the Memorial Union Terrace in The Last Kiss, in which Zach Braff gets mixed up in a campus romance. And then there's King Street in I Love Trouble, which finds reporters Julia Roberts and Nick Nolte covering a story in Wisconsin.
Oh, perfect. We're going to pass by the best frozen yogurt joint in the entire state.
Yeah? It's on Peterson.
You okay?
What the hell was that all about?
No argument with the authentic locations in these productions, but the plots and the acting are so bad that you feel embarrassed on the city's behalf. It's hard to believe, but Madison's one shining moment in Hollywood movies is Back to School, a 1986 Rodney Dangerfield comedy. The film won no awards for its crude story of a millionaire who joins his son as a freshman at UW-Madison, renamed Grand Lakes University.
Hey, folks, it's on me. Shakespeare for everyone, okay?
Who is that?
That is Mr. Thornton Mellon, the world's oldest living freshman.
But Dangerfield works hard for laughs, and he gets just enough of them. From the local perspective, though, the film's real charm is its loving view of Madison. Here, the city pretends to be nothing other than itself, and it's never looked better on screen. Residents will recognize the unique light of fall semester, with leaves crunching underfoot. This time, picturesque buildings like the Red Gym and Science Hall aren't just cameos, but stars of the show. Just when you start thinking you'd love to live in such a dreamy place, you realize, to your amazement, that you do.
My life was a nonstop Hollywood movie show.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. He's won state and national awards for arts, features, and news stories, and has contributed to magazines and newspapers around the country. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Because celluloid heroes never feel any pain.
We're taking a look now at the confirmation hearings that are underway for Governor Tony Evers' cabinet nominees. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Late last year, as then-Governor-elect Tony Evers announced his first cabinet picks, he said, quote, "I'm seeking talent and to have a cabinet that looks like the people of Wisconsin." The full Senate must vote to approve Governor Evers' cabinet secretaries, and Senate hearings are underway. We'll begin with looking at testimony from Corrections Secretary-designee Kevin Carr. What are your thoughts on Governor Evers' picks for corrections and transportation secretaries? What are the policy biggest changes you think need to happen in Wisconsin when it comes to criminal justice and transportation? We're at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sean is a WPR State Capitol reporter, and thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have to start first by asking you about this news about the GOP tax cut plan. Yesterday, Governor Evers issued his first veto against the plan. Can you bring us up to date on that?
So this was the veto that pretty much everybody saw coming, I think. Evers had signaled for a long time that he was unhappy with the Republican tax cut plan, had never gone so far as saying, yes, I will veto it, but had never given any indication he would sign it. And so he did go ahead and veto it. It's kind of significant. Symbolically, it's the first bill they sent to him. This is the first action, kind of major legislative action he's taking as governor. In his veto message, he talked about how he was troubled that the bill was passed outside of the regular budget process, that it wouldn't be paid for. He was troubled that it didn't have bipartisan support. And he said he's going to introduce his own income tax cut as part of his budget, which, again, is something he said for a while now.
So yesterday's confirmation hearing, Secretary-designee of the Department of Corrections, Kevin Carr, faced his confirmation yesterday. First of all, what is his background?
I'll tell you, I did not cover the Kevin Carr hearing, and I don't know his background as well as I do some of the other committee hearings. I do know that what he talked about yesterday.
You covered transportation. I'm sorry.
I did.
Yeah. Sorry. So you were covering Craig Thompson. So why don't we start with Craig Thompson?
All right. So Craig Thompson has kind of a long history around the transportation issue in one form or another. He's most recently worked with the Wisconsin Transportation Development Association, which it includes a kind of a wide variety of groups. It represents road builders. It represents local governments. I think that road builder tie is what's getting most attention with Craig Thompson. He also, before that, worked for the Wisconsin Counties Association, I believe, and, you know, generally has kind of a low-key personality, is very good with details when it comes to transportation, and has been around this issue as the state over the last decade in particular has talked about, you know, what the heck are we going to do with road funding. Thompson's
We're talking with Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. We're talking about state Senate confirmation hearings that were held yesterday, and this one for Transportation Department Secretary-designee Craig Thompson. Sean, I cut you off there mid-sentence as we went to a break there, but I want you to carry on with what you saw in Craig Thompson's hearing there yesterday.
So, the hearing was really low-key. I think with Thompson, it's kind of an interesting confirmation story because it seems like of all the Evers secretaries, his confirmation is perhaps the one that's in doubt. You might not know it, though, just listening to this confirmation hearing. He was the only person who testified. The committee is 3 Republicans and 2 Democrats. I wouldn't say that his feet were really held to the fire or anything. I mean, that they had kind of questions about, even had questions about specific road projects in their districts. There were nobody there testifying against him. And you know, there were just registrations from a wide variety of groups that supported Craig Thompson's, you know, nomination to be transportation secretary. All that said, he is not necessarily a shoo-in to get that job, but the people in that room liked him.
So how likely is Thompson to be confirmed by the Republican majority Senate?
I think the question is where there's this group of Republicans in the Senate who I think you could say held up any kind of tax or fee increase in the Senate in the last legislative session. Maybe there were others, but there's this outspoken group in the Senate. They include senators like Dewey Strobel, like Steve Noss, like Senator Craig. There is also Senator Kapinga in the Senate. There's this kind of small coalition that sticks together on a lot of transportation funding stuff. And their issue with Thompson is his work on the Transportation Development Association and, you know, its connections to road builders. While it's not the only group that the TDA represents, you know, these senators feel like those road builder ties are too much for them, potentially.
So this is a lobbying organization that's represented transportation stakeholders in the state?
Yeah, and because one of those stakeholders is the road builders, road builders will consistently push for road funding. I mean, that's kind of part of their nature. When there's talk about whether or not the state should have some kind of a tax or fee increase to pay for roads in the long term, the answer is generally yes. And the answer for these 4 or 5 Republican senators when it comes to that question is generally no. They feel like the state's spending too much on roads and they just want to kind of stand firm against any of that.
What is Thompson's background beyond that position?
I think, you know, going, he said that he'd worked for the counties back into the 90s. So he, I think, came into the road funding issue from the perspective of a local government. And they have a huge stake in road funding. You know, most of the roads in Wisconsin by far are local roads. They might get some state aid to pay for those roads, but they're local roads. And so whenever the state is talking about road funding issues, it's a local issue too. And so he has kind of that perspective as he goes into this debate. And that's something that he said in the hearing yesterday, is that, we need to deal with those local roads who make up such a huge portion of the highways in Wisconsin.
We're talking with Sean Johnson. He is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, talking about state Senate confirmation hearing yesterday that were held yesterday for Transportation Secretary Designee Craig Thompson. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Governor Evers' pick for Transportation Secretary, his pick for other appointments, other secretary appointments? What are the biggest policy changes you think need to happen in Wisconsin when it comes to transportation? And how do these issues affect your community? How do they hit home? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Sean, during the hearing yesterday, did Thompson indicate what his priorities as Transportation Department Secretary would be?
One of the things he said was that he'd view the department's success on, you know, whether people see an improvement in their transportation system. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about people not being happy with the conditions of roads right now. You would presume that would need to change in order for Thompson to measure his time there as success. And he pivoted right from that, though, to talking about the way that we need to fund roads in Wisconsin. And in his view, that it needs to be kind of a user fee system. So right now, those the biggest user fees that pay for those are gas taxes and registration fees. Those haven't gone up in a long time. I mean, the gas tax hasn't gone up since about 2006. So because Wisconsin has gotten away from that, it's had to rely on other forms of funding, chiefly borrowing, and borrowing more and more in Wisconsin. That's something that Thompson said he wants to address.
You know, Sean, we're not political reporters here. We don't sit in on these hearings. But when we think of confirmation hearings, I think, at least I think of more of them at the federal level, and testimony and hours and hours of testimony. Are the procedures pretty similar, or what is it like at the state level for these confirmation hearings?
I would say take all the drama that you see at a confirmation hearing on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., and dial it down about as far as it goes most of the time. Most confirmation hearings are not all that confrontational. You know, I think you start with the presumption in state government that if a governor nominates someone to a cabinet position, there's a pretty good chance that they are going to get that job, that they won't. I mean, all these people are already working in these jobs, too. Craig Thompson is, in effect, already our transportation secretary. The state Senate could not confirm him and you know, vote to fire him, basically. But he's the transportation secretary now. And the presumption, I think, you go into these things with is they're going to get the jobs. And these hearings are, even with Thompson's, you know, there were a number of reporters there because there's some conflict here. There's a little drama. But drama was notably absent from this hearing. There were a lot of people there to listen, you know, a lot of lobbyists there to register their support. But there was not a lot of conflict at this hearing.
Okay, so there are 17 cabinet members. Where are we in this process of confirmations?
Just hearings so far. So there have been a handful who've had hearings, you know, like Craig Thompson did yesterday, like Department of Corrections Secretary Designee Kevin Carr did yesterday. They've had these hearings. Not everybody's had them. And the Senate hasn't voted on any of them yet. I mean, we're very early in the legislative session. Even though the legislature did send a tax cut bill to the governor's desk, they are still getting started, basically, in terms of meeting, passing stuff, voting on secretaries.
And these hearings, as yesterday, are before a committee, and then the full Senate still must vote on these cabinet picks. Is that right?
That's right. And so that's where I guess the real potential conflict comes, because the senators who have a potential issue with Craig Thompson in particular don't sit on the Transportation Committee. You know, there are senators on the Transportation Committee who seem to have a pretty good rapport with Craig Thompson. The ones like I mentioned earlier, Dewey Strobel, Chris Kapminga, Steve Nass, others who potentially have problems with the DOT, they're in the Senate. And so it's really going to be they have enough numbers within that small group to hold things up if they stick together. So the question for them is whether they want to do that on Craig Thompson, because, you know, if it's not Craig Thompson, it's going to be somebody else that they might not they particularly care for either. You don't know. Thompson is not, I mean, he's not a combative person at all. He lays out the facts. I think there are senators who would disagree with his view that the state needs revenue. But he's, like, again, pretty low-key and pretty straightforward when it comes to talking about roads.
So, Sean, you know, how long might this take for all of these cabinet picks to be confirmed or not? How long in the legislative session might this go?
I think this will be wrapped up pretty early in the session. Typically, it doesn't necessarily have to be. In the past, you have seen some confirmations for other positions that people just stayed in the position without that Senate confirmation. They did their jobs. They were effectively the leaders of agencies, but the Senate never gave them its blessing. So, I mean, that's been a possibility in the past. that they did make some changes to the confirmation process, like tweaks in the lame duck session last year. I'm not entirely sure what that would do to the timeline, but I think most of these people, there's going to be a vote on them in the early going, because the Senate, the Assembly, the governor are going to be haggling over the budget from here until at least summer.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. We've been taking a look at the confirmation hearings that are underway for Governor Tony Evner's cabinet nominees, talking there about the Transportation Secretary designee Craig Thompson. Next hour, we'll be with Laurel White, WPR's State Capitol reporter, looking at Corrections Secretary designee Kevin Carr. And now we're going to switch gears here and talk about abolitionist teaching. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.
They've got so much things to say right now. They've got so much things to say, yeah. They've got so much things to say right now. They've got so much things to say.
We're examining this concept called abolitionist teaching and how to stamp out long-held injustices and oppression in public schools. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This approach involves working hand-in-hand with communities of color, driven by an urgency to make real, meaningful community changes when children of color are operating in survival mode. How do we create equitable classrooms and ensure students feel safe in school? Questions we'll examine with you at 800-642-1234. Are you a teacher or a student? What are your insights on educational inequities in Wisconsin and around the country? What do you think should be done to address racial and socioeconomic disparities in education? Bettina Love is an author and an associate professor of educational theory and practice at the University of Georgia. She was a fellow at Harvard, and her new book is We Want to Do More Than Survive: Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. Bettina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with your start in education. You began teaching second and third graders in Homestead, Florida, close to the Everglades and in the southern tip of the state. What was your experience like there in starting out in education?
Well, you know, it was an amazing experience to be a brand new teacher, not from Florida, not even from the South. I was born and raised in upstate New York. And to move to Miami, it just opened my eyes to so much. My school sent out permission slips in three different languages. And I was just immersed in so many different cultures, so many different traditions, so many different ways of understanding school from so many different identities, from a socioeconomic identity, a language identity, a race identity. And it just opened my eyes as a first-year teacher to the beauty of what diversity can look like in a school and the importance of diversity in a school. And it was just a great experience.
How did that teaching work and what you saw there in Southern Florida, how was that a springboard for what you did next?
So I really decided that I wanted to think more deeply about education. I was figuring things out. I was new to the teaching field, but I knew that I wanted to kind of think more deeply about all these issues that I was seeing. And so that led me out of the classroom really into a PhD program. And I think I always wanted to get a PhD, even in, you know, in my master's. That was something that I really wanted to do. But I didn't know what I wanted to do until I started teaching. And I saw how culture and using students' culture could be a driver for educational achievement. And then I also saw how inequality and how students and their families and their communities are trying to fight systematic inequalities and what that meant for a kid in the classroom. And that was really one of some of the drivers that, you know, got me out of the classroom and really started thinking more deeply about this in a PhD program.
So there are major, major racial disparities across the country when it comes to education, and Wisconsin is not, certainly not immune from that. Black students had a 30% lower high school graduation rate than their white peers in 2017. And you argue that the way we approach these inequalities isn't providing any real solutions, and it may be even making these problems worse. Why is that?
You know, I think that we approach the issue from a very deficient mindset. And, you know, this is Wisconsin Radio. You all have one of the leading scholars in this idea of this achievement gap. And Gloria Latson-Billings from, you know, UMass says we don't have an achievement gap. We have an educational debt. And so what is happening is that when we think about how do we best serve these students, we think about that from an idea that, you know, they're not worthy at the beginning of the conversation. And so we just want to put a Band-Aid on things. We don't want to hire the best teachers to work into these schools. We don't want to give them a curriculum that is stimulating, that is engaging. We want to put metal detectors and make their schools feel like prisons. And so when you do these particular type of things, school is not fun, school is not safe, school is not engaging, school doesn't feel like the place that I want to be. And then you say, well, why are these kids learning? It's pretty difficult to learn in a space where you don't see yourself, you don't see your culture, your school is mimicking a prison. It's very hard to learn. And then we haven't undone the debt that we owe Black and brown people in this country. And so we're trying to play catch up without the proper tools to catch up.
You have issue with the phrase achievement gap. It's a term we hear so much about educational inequalities, particularly between students of color and white students. What issues do you see with labeling these problems as an achievement gap?
Well, first of all, you can't call something a gap that you created. So, yes, white students outperform Black students on achievement tests. Okay. But if you know that these students have been systematically for hundreds of years, right? This country had 260 years of slavery, 90 years of Jim Crow. Many of our students that are coming to college are first-generation college students. They're not first-generation college students because their parents didn't want them to go to college. It's the first group you let in. So, yes, we know that students are not achieving as well as white students, but they shouldn't. It is very hard to play catch-up all the time. And so to say we have an achievement gap without talking about any of the systematic issues of institutional racism, of poverty that was created. Black people are not asking to be in poverty. This thing is created. And so when you talk about the achievement gap having the conversation and it's ahistorical, you're not doing a service. And you're misleading individuals to thinking that Black students can't achieve. We don't have a capacity problem. We have a funding problem. We have institutional debt that needs to be paid. And so that's why I have a problem with the achievement gap, because you automatically have a conversation that's not including a history of what has happened to Black folks and brown folks and indigenous folks in this country.
We're taking a critical look at inequities in education for children of color and what Bettina Love calls the educational survival complex. Her book is What We Want to Do. Her book is Abolitionist Teaching. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a student of color or a parent of students of color? What has your experience been navigating the educational system? Are you a parent of a child whose school teaches character traits? Is your child assessed on things like grit and determination? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And Bettina Love's book is We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. Bettina, help us understand what you mean by this educational survival complex and where you see this status quo.
So I'm arguing that schools have never really been, for black and brown children and indigenous children, a place that we were there to survive. And what do I mean by that? You look at schools for Native American children in the 1800s. Those schools were simply to say that Native Americans, we want you to cut your hair, we want you to lose your language, we want you to assimilate, and that's going to be your schooling experience. That's not a school for Native American children to thrive. We talked about English-only education in the 1800s. That's not a school for kids to thrive and to be embraced in their culture and learn multiple languages. We said, okay, we're going to have Brown, we're going to say schools are separate but equal. Then we're going to have Brown versus the Board of Education. Then after Brown, we have white flight and the gutting of our public schools. And so when you think about education and the educational system, we have never truly given students of color a school system that is really thoughtfully caring about their thriving. Just that they survive it, they get through, we hope you make it, great. And then also, the next step of that educational survival system that I talk about in the book is that they profit off of our suffering. And I kind of say this is similar to the prison industrial complex. And so you have charter schools, and you have a testing company, and you have hedge fund managers, and all of these individuals are profiting when black students don't achieve. The prisons, the testing companies, the hedge fund managers. So this is also an idea of a complex, because they're ensuring that as long as black and brown students are not achieving, they're going to find ways to make money off that. That's what I mean by the prison industrial complex.
And how do you break up that complex? How do you start to reform?
I think we have to reimagine what schools can be, and then we have to think about not only reimagining, how do we create a new system? Number one, we got to get testing out of our schools. You can't have the testing agency say, hey, take our test. Oh, you know what? Your kids didn't do well on the test. Now we're going to sell you more testing materials. We'll sell you more benchmarking. You know what? Now we want to have one of our specialists come in and train all your teachers on the test, and we're going to charge you for that too. You have to get testing. Testing is a big billion-dollar business in our schools right now. And then they make legislation to make sure they keep the testing in. We have to get testing out of schools. We have to think about more creative ways. We have to get metal detectors. We should be putting school counselors and therapists in our schools, not police, not metal detectors, not dogs. These things don't belong in education. And so we just have to say enough is enough, and we want them out of our schools.
We're forming new ideas around inclusivity and what abolitionist teaching means and to actually walk the walk. Bettina Love is our guide. Her book is We Want to Do More Than Survive. There's time for you in this conversation about abolitionist teaching. What stands out here that you want to ask about in your school and in your community? Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. We're finding out how to help root out injustices, confront racism directly, and build community in schools to encourage kids to be themselves, and as Bettina Love writes, to give this world hell. Her new book is called We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. Let's go to the phones now with Sarah joining us from Green Bay. Sarah, hi. What are your thoughts here?
Hi, good morning. First of all, I just want to thank you for having this conversation. But I also just, as a white teacher who is trying to engage with this work and trying to engage with these conversations, but in an environment in our nation where I think white folks are kind of in denial that there is an opportunity gap, what recommendations can you provide for me trying to do this work in my district?
Sarah, thanks. Bettina, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, I was actually in Wisconsin last weekend with Middletown Schools and had a very engaging conversation with a school district that is very much almost all white. And the conversation, I think, first of all, has to be that we do this work as far as talking about race in small chunks consistently and having engaged conversations. This idea that we're going to somehow, you know, a white teacher like yourself is going to, you know, engage your peers in this conversation and it's just going to go well right out the gate, that's probably not going to work. So the work has to be intentional and the work has to be consistently engaging. So I would say the first thing is for like-minded white teachers to get a group to start having these conversations and try to bring more people slowly along until you have a mass of folks. But it has to start out grassroots. I would also say for white teachers to get involved with their local community groups and see what they're doing, how they're tackling these issues. Because it has to be about solidarity. It has to be about teachers understanding that it's not just about educational justice. We need housing justice, too. We need queer justice. We need health care. So trying to get teachers to engage in all of these issues and where they intersect education. But the first thing you got to do is try to have these conversations in safe places, small groups, so people start to feel comfortable and start to understand that what they're doing in the classroom can be harmful. And I think for teachers, that's a very hard thing to think about, that I'm doing harm to my kids, that I'm not, you say I don't love my kids, you say I don't care about my kids. And so white folks and white teachers get very defensive. And so we have to try to find spaces where they can feel like they can have an open conversation. And I think that has to be with other white people that want to do this good work, and then for those other white people to take it small and consistent, and then try to get a large group of people to really be thinking about these things to change schools.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Let's go to Michael now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning. You know, unfortunately, one of the obstacles that I see, and I actually left education after about 20 years just because of the administrative and structural climate that stymies a lot of that kind of progress. You know, we do have models that show community engagement and higher academic achievement. Shiraki Holly schools out in LA Unified come to mind. Unfortunately, a lot of those models fly against a lot of the strategic plans and a lot of the fluffy statements that administrators try to spin on what they're trying to do with, you know, making all students succeed or helping all students, you know, graduate. I mean, all these blanket statements and broad brushstrokes that sound great, but they lack, as like what the previous caller was getting into, the community engagement and the connection with the parents and really building a school that has an identity of the people with whom they're serving.
Mike,
all I really wanted to say.
Yeah, Michael, thank you for those thoughts. Bettina, what about building that community, and how do you start?
Well, I want to just say one thing about Michael's point. He's exactly right. Many of our school initiatives are gimmicks. They're fluffy. They really have no type of institutional support. They're really just here to just say, we got some acronyms, we got some things that are just fluffy. They're not rooted in the community. And I think what we have to do is we have to make the school part of the community. The school has to be a deep part of the community. The school should be staying open. The kids should be there till late at night. The parents should be coming in. It should be a place where parents feel like, and the community feels like, this is another piece that is critical for the community to be successful. And that should be the school. The school should not be closed to the community. The school should be a part of the community. And we have to start engaging parents to have that conversation, for them to come up to the school, to feel like the school is the place that wants them. The school is we cannot do this work without you. Come into the school. Invite them into the school. Ask the parents, what kind of programs do you want? And do those programs. Have those programs done for the parents. Don't expect the parents to do it. If we're talking about working-class parents, they don't have time to come into the school every day. Ask them, what do they need? How can we be helpful? And then open the school up to the community. Don't be afraid of the community. Be part of the community.
Bettina, you write about abolitionist teaching is not a teaching approach exactly. It's a way of life. It's a way of seeing the world and a way of taking action against injustice. So how do you live it? How do you make this more of a worldview instead of just a micro classroom view?
Right. So the reason I say it can't just be a teaching approach, because it has to be fundamentally the way that you want to see the world. And what I mean by that is seeing the world with a racial lens, saying, calling out racism, calling out sexism, calling out homophobia, talking to your teachers about that. That's not a teaching practice. That's the way to see the world. Then you take that into the classroom. So abolitionist teaching is about marching, is about protesting with parents, with other teachers, with students, not only on educational issues, but on issues of black folks and brown folks and immigration, of police shootings, of fair pay, of housing justice, all of those issues that are impacting all of us, but particularly impacting black and brown folks. Teachers need to be deeply engaged with all of those issues. And so abolitionist teaching is saying, listen, it's not just about what you do in the classroom. It's about the way you live your life that is dedicated towards justice and all forms of justice. And then you take that and then you bring that into the classroom first, not the other way around.
When you left your hometown, Rochester, New York, you didn't want to go back, and you write about not wanting to repeat the mistakes that your parents made. How have you been able to find your place? And when you go home, do you see home in a different way?
You know, I write about Rochester, New York, because I wanted to talk about what it meant to grow up in the 80s in a small, you know, Rochester, New York is not New York City. It's upstate New York, close to Canada. But Rochester was an anomaly in the 80s. You know, it was a small city that had a big industry. And so I really wanted to tell the story of what it meant as a kid to see working class folks, to see folks who this huge industry from Kodak to Xerox to Bosch Alarm to Paychex thriving, like a community that was thriving, and how that's done. And it's done with work. It's done with giving people fair wages. And so I really wanted to have that conversation in the book. And then also what I learned in Rochester is I got politicized. I was a young kid who was in a program called FIS, Fighting Ignorance, Spreading Truth, and it taught me so much. I had black teachers, wonderful black teachers who cared about me, who saw me as more than just their student, but saw me as their child. So I wanted to write about Rochester, New York, because in the 80s it was a flourishing place for me, that I had community centers and Boys and Girls Club centers on every corner. As a kid, I could just go anywhere I wanted to go. We went to museums for free. We went to the movies for free. We went to sports games for free. I had the community center with folks who loved me and took care of me. I had black teachers. My parents had two jobs that supported our home. It was a great place to live. And then that industry crashed. Kodak, gone. Xerox, gone. And it was devastated. Now, Rochester, when you look at categories of achievement or you look at crime, you know, Rochester is not doing as well as it did, and in many categories, very far from that city that I knew in the 80s.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Bettina, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Bettina Love is author of We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. We've been talking about this practice of working in solidarity with communities of color while drawing on many different qualities and ideas that will root out injustices. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.